to this audio edition of Philip Pusher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparella, and concerts by the CSO on Thursday, January 30th through Tuesday, February 4th, feature guest conductor Esa-Pekka Salonen and organ soloist Iveta Abkalna. The program includes Don Juan by Richard Strauss, Salonen's Sinfonia Concertante for organ and orchestra, and after intermission, Béla Bartók's Concerto for orchestra. Here are Philip Pusher's program notes on Richard Strauss's Don Juan, a work lasting about 18 minutes. Although he would later say that he found himself as inspiring a subject as any, Richard Strauss began his career composing music indebted to some of literature's greatest characters. Strauss claimed that his inspiration to write music about Don Juan came from Nicolas Lanoz's German verse play left unfinished at his death, but it's worth considering that Strauss conducted Mozart's Don Giovanni in Munich shortly before he began to compose Don Juan, his first important work. Don Juan launched Strauss's career, but it took a few years for his name to replace that of another Strauss in audiences' affection. When the Chicago Symphony played Don Juan for the first time in 1897, it was still necessary to report that the 24-year-old composer was no relation to the Dance Strauss family. In fact, the seeds for Strauss's Don Juan were planted as early as 1885 when he attended a performance of Paul Heyse's play Don Juan's Ende. Strauss's Don Juan is not Heyse's, nor Mozart's, nor Lanoz's, despite words on the title page to the contrary, but a character entirely and unforgettably his own, defined in a few sharp musical gestures. Now that Strauss's tone poem, the term he preferred, has conquered the world's concert halls, the figure of Don Juan is unimaginable without the ardent horn theme, which, in Strauss's hands, becomes his calling card. Strauss once said his two favorite operas were Tristan and Isolde and Così fan tutte, and this work is informed by both the Wagnerian idea of undying love as well as Mozart's understanding of passion as a fragile, ever-changing state of mind. It's no small coincidence that at the time he was composing this tone poem, Strauss himself fell madly in love with Paulina de Anna, the soprano, who would eventually become his wife. Strauss worked on two tone poems during the summer of 1888. Macbeth, which gave him considerable trouble and wasn't finished until 1891, doesn't profit from comparison with Shakespeare's play. But with Don Juan, composed in just 4 months, Strauss discovered the knack, which would rarely desert him thereafter, for depicting character, place, and action of cinematic complexity so vividly that words of explanation are unnecessary. Still, Strauss prefaced the score of Don Juan with three excerpts from Lanoz's poem, and at the earliest performances, he asked to have those lines printed in the program. Later, realizing that the public could follow his tone poems in essence, if not blow by blow, he disdained such self-help guides and trusted the music to speak for itself. Strauss was always a master of the memorable first line. Think of the glorious daybreak, now so often misquoted in television commercials, at the beginning of Thus Spake Zarathustra. But in all music, there are few openings as breathtaking as that of Don Juan, a rapid unfurling in which the hero leaps headlong in front of us. Throughout the work, Strauss doesn't skimp on details, for even in his abridged biography of the great lover, he depicts at least one flirtation, two torrid affairs, and a duel to the death. There are many remarkable moments. The deeply felt love scene at the heart of the piece beautifully launched by the oboe, the brazen new signature theme that follows played by the four horns in unison, the hero's precipitous fall from grace when memories of his most recent loves pass quickly before him. Finally, after reliving the glory of past conquests, Don Juan recognizes that his victory is hollow. The fuel is all consumed, and the hearth is cold and dark, Lanoz writes, and he willingly dies at his adversary's hand. With one piercing stab from the trumpets, he drops, trembling, to the ground. As swiftly as Don Juan's life had ended, Strauss's dazzling career was launched. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Don Juan by Richard Strauss. And now on to Esa-Pekka Salonen's Sinfonia Concertante for Organ and Orchestra. The work lasts about 34 minutes. Chicago audiences first knew Esa-Pekka Salonen as a conductor for his Chicago Symphony Orchestra debut in 1988. He led music by Haydn, Bartok, and Nielsen. Salonen didn't conduct one of his own scores here until 2003, when he gave the U.S. premiere of Insomnia, a dark and turbulent nocturne he had composed the year before. Since then, we've learned to identify him as one of the few major musical figures today who is both a composer and conductor of distinction, a combination that was once a staple of the music world, but has become increasingly rare. When Salonen entered the Sibelius Academy in Helsinki in the 1970s, it was to study horn and composition. He enrolled in Jorma Ponnola's conducting class because he felt that young composers should learn to lead their own works. Composing remained Salonen's focus. In Helsinki, he studied with the visionary Ainu-Juhani Rautavaara. In the early 1980s, he worked with Niccolò Castiglione in Milan and in the Finnish Broadcasting Company studios. His earliest large-scale orchestral works date from this time. Then, after leading an acclaimed performance of Mahler's Third Symphony on short notice in London in 1983, Salonen soon became an internationally known conductor for whom composing was a sideline. More than a decade passed before he found the time to complete another major work, the L.A. Variations, written to showcase the L.A. Philharmonic, of which he was music director at the time of its premiere in 1997. Salonen continues to negotiate balancing the two sides of his musical life. It is a battle that has been famously fought before by figures as different in their solutions and in the music they wrote as Gustav Mahler, Leonard Bernstein, and Pierre Boulez. Boulez said his conducting career followed a bell curve. It started as a sideline, grew until it nearly overtook his composing, and finally settled into a more comfortable balance. After Salonen took a year sabbatical from conducting in 2000 in order to devote himself full-time to writing music, he admitted that he felt it impossible to work on both sides simultaneously. But the past few years have also erased any doubts that one cannot excel at both, the age-old suspicion Salonen has often encountered that if you do two things, one must be fake, surely, because nobody can do two things well. As he told the New York Times, it is a strange statement to make because you go 100 years back and every musician was also a composer. In recent years, Salonen has conducted many of his major works in Chicago, including three concertos played here by the original performers, pianist Yefim Bronfman in 2008, violinist Lila Josefowitz in 2011, and Yo-Yo Ma in the world premiere of his cello concerto in 2017, as well as Nix in 2014, Foreign Bodies in 2016, and Gemini in 2022. When he was awarded the prestigious Nemmers Prize in Music Composition by the Beenin School of Music at Northwestern University in 2014, he said in his acceptance remarks that the Chicago Orchestra has long been a musical home away from home for me. And here are words by Esa-Pekka Salonen on Sinfonia Concertante for Organ and Orchestra. Salonen writes, I started developing material for the Sinfonia Concertante in the lockdown spring of 2020. It took me a while to get over the first obvious hurdle. The organ can cover the entire scope of a symphony orchestra in every way. It has the same or wider pitch, dynamics, and color ranges. How does one write a piece for essentially two orchestras without creating redundancy issues? After a lot of thinking and at times agonizing, I had the Columbus's egg moment. Why not just write the music and orchestrate it for those two rich and complex instruments, the organ and orchestra? I decided to call the composition Sinfonia Concertante instead of a concerto, as the function of the organ keeps changing constantly over the course of the 30-minute journey. Sometimes it plays alone, often as the soloist in the traditional sense, or as a chamber music partner to wind instruments. A few times it becomes part of the orchestra as a member of the collective in a supporting role. I cannot think of any other instrument with the same chameleon-like flexibility. The long history of the organ inspired me to imagine old music from a hypothetical world, an alternate universe, still mine but slightly alien. I decided to use old forms, such as the slow, courtly pavane in the first movement. There's only one actual quote in the Sinfonia Concertante, a famous Ars Antigua four-part organa Viderunt Omnes by Perrotin, which I reharmonized and orchestrated for full orchestra and solo organ. I've been a Perrotin fan since my teen years. Here's a short map of the three movements. Movement 1, Pavane and Drones. 1. After a dreamy opening section, the solo organ introduces the pavane, my take on the stately Renaissance court dance. The strings join after a while. The organ decorates their phase. 2. A semitone trill drone sounds throughout the new, more unsettled section, where the filigree lines of the organ are sometimes accompanied by the woodwind instruments. The pavane returns in a different guise in the bassoons and later in the horns. The semitone trill has grown to a whole tone, which in my mind grew into a major dramaturgical moment, a real peripetia. 3. After another filigree solo passage, the pavane returns suddenly, this time forte, played by the full orchestra. After a massive culmination, the unsettled organ filigree is heard for the last time. 4. The dreamy opening music returns, orchestrated very sparingly. The organ plays the melodic line accompanied by long glissandos of two solo violins. The movement ends in stillness. Movement 2, Variations and Dirge. 1. Solo viola and the English horn play a slow, nostalgic melody, accompanied by quiet, calmly ascending and descending lines. Those scales will be returning soon. 2. The organ plays the first cadenza. It begins like an innocuous Baroque Siciliano, but grows more frenzied in expression as it progresses. 3. A short variation of the up and down movement heard in the beginning, this time at breakneck speed. 4. The second cadenza. The Siciliano music is now in the pedal, low and powerful. 5. The third variation of the scales, a long adagio, which culminates when the unison strings reach the highest points of the melody. And 6. Dirge for the organ alone. My mother died during the last stages of the composition process. I decided to write an epilogue in her memory. It doesn't sound sad, more like a big ship sailing away. And movement 3, Ghost Montage. 1. Noisy music inspired by the organ riffs heard in NHL ice hockey games in the United States. Echoes of Beethoven's 7th also, I believe. 2. Old music from my imagined world, played by woodwinds mostly. 3. The organ joins, and we hear a quieter variation of the opening carnival music, this time with pizzicato strings. 4. Long solo episode for the organ. The complex chords in the beginning give way to another version of the old music. 5. The carnival returns, this time intertwined with the old music. 6. Another long organ solo, which leads to the Perrotin sequence. 7. A sudden, loud tutti leads to the first cadenza, massive chords over a pedal point on B natural. 8. Another tutti outburst and a second cadenza, this time a virtuoso moment for the pedal. And 9. The opening music returns faster than before. The organ and the orchestra have changed places. The organ plays what the orchestra played earlier and vice versa. Out of the massive B-flat major chord emerges another alien chord that ends the entire piece pianissimo. Another ghost. words by Esa-Pekka Salonen, and program notes by Philip Huscher on Salonen's Sinfonia Concertante for Organ and Orchestra. And now, on to Béla Bartók's Concerto for Orchestra, a work lasting about 34 minutes. For all the prestige his music commands today among American orchestras, Béla Bartók was unhappy and largely ignored during the last 4 years of his life, which he spent in this country. The sad departure from his native Hungary in late 1940 to escape the Nazi invasion was a nightmare itself for both Bartók and his wife, Dita, with a furtive night train trip through Italy to Switzerland, passage by bus through France, a merciless customs inspection at the Spanish border, a night spent wandering through Lisbon in search of a place to sleep, and finally a rough crossing on an American cargo ship with all luggage left behind. The first weeks in New York were little better. The English language was a minefield, and home was now a Spartan hotel room. The Bartóks were perplexed by American ways, like eating cracked wheat for breakfast, and they were dumbfounded by a subway system so vast they once spent 3 hours wandering underground before they emerged, shamefaced, into the sunlight. Bartók complained of creative impotence, and in truth he wrote nothing of substance during his first 2 years here. He played a few scattered concerts, including a duo recital with his wife in Chicago that got very bad reviews. One, as bad as I never got in my life, according to the composer, his mastery of our tongue, still as uncertain as his verdict on life in America. In April 1942, Bartók's health took a turn for the worse. Several medical examinations proved inconclusive. There were good days and bad, periods of high fever, occasional hospital stays. Pain in his joints made walking difficult. It was, truly, the beginning of the end. And then, like the miracle great music always is, a masterpiece was born. In May 1943, Serge Koussevitzky, music director of the Boston Symphony, visited Bartók in his hospital room, prepared to write a check for $500, half payment, for an orchestral piece he wished to commission in memory of his late wife, Olga. Bartók was reluctant, fearing he wouldn't be able to complete the work, but he finally accepted the offer and Koussevitzky's check. Had Bartók known the truth, he never would have agreed. The suggestion for the commission had not come directly from Koussevitzky, never a champion of Bartók before, but from Josef Szigeti and Fritz Reiner, who greatly admired Bartók's music and knew him well enough to know that he would refuse any effort he viewed as charity. The Bartóks spent the summer at Saranac Lake in the Adirondacks. At first, Bartók busied himself prowling around the local library. He read an English translation of Don Quixote with no apparent difficulty. By mid-August, he was ready to put pen to paper and found, to his surprise, that he was working practically day and night on the Koussevitzky commission. At least temporarily, his health improved, and when he returned to New York in October, he took the finished score with him. Perhaps it is due to this improvement, he had written to Szigeti, or it may be the other way around, that I have been able to finish the work that Koussevitzky commissioned. Koussevitzky, who conducted the first performance with the Boston Symphony in December 1944, called the Concerto for Orchestra the best orchestral piece of the last 25 years, an assessment few were to challenge. A word about Bartók's title, Concerto for Orchestra. Bartók's work wasn't the first, but only the most celebrated example to bear this seemingly paradoxical title, which focuses the spotlight not on one solo instrument, but on the orchestra itself. Hindemith, Walter Piston, and Bartók's fellow Hungarian and dear friend, Zoltán Kodály, had written concertos for orchestra before him, just as Michael Tippett, Elliot Gardiner, and Shulamit Ron would after his great success. The Concerto for Orchestra is a particularly 20th century idea, a reflection of the unprecedented virtuosity of the modern orchestra and of the desire to pour new wine into old bottles. With no traditional form to follow, Bartók picked one he often favored, a symmetrical, mirror-like arrangement of five movements, with a large, dark-hued andante at the center, light, quicker interludes on either side, and a powerful, fast movement to anchor each end. The first sounds we hear are full of mystery and gloom, which don't begin to suggest the sunlight, dancing, and outright humor that are right around the corner. The tone of both the opening movement and the central elegia is stern, even tragic. The second and fourth movements will disrupt the mood, but only the life-asserting finale can dispel it. The Gioco della Coppia is one of Bartók's most celebrated creations, in which pairs, coppie, of instruments take turns presenting an unprepossessing little tune launched by two bassoons at the interval of a sixth, and followed by oboes in thirds, clarinets in sevenths, flutes in fifths, and muted trumpets in major seconds. The elegia for Olga Kusevitsky is, in Bartók's words, a lugubrious death song. It's also a prime example of the composer's night music, full of haunting, evocative sounds, and ultimately, a deep calm. The intermezzo interrotto is exactly that, an interrupted intermezzo, the disruption being the march tune of Shostakovich's Leningrad Symphony. Bartók first heard the symphony on the radio in Saranac Lake and thought the marching theme so banal he couldn't resist saying so, in music that dissects the tune and then holds it up to the ridicule of the entire orchestra. It's also worth remembering that Bartók had long questioned Kusevitsky's championship of Shostakovich's music at the neglect of his own. Bartók wasn't a vindictive or mean-spirited man, but surely he enjoyed having the last laugh. The finale is dance music, brilliant and lively, especially in its perpetua mobile sections, based on a straightforward, singable tune and constructed with the contrapuntal dexterity of a master craftsman. It is, above all, a life-affirming statement from a man close to death. Bartók attended the triumphant premiere of the Concerto for Orchestra in December 1944, perhaps detecting the first signs of a new wave of enthusiasm for his music. In the remaining months of his life, he completed all but the last few measures of the third piano concerto. He left a viola concerto commissioned by William Primrose in a pile of sketches, later reconstructed by Tibor Charlie. Bartók was unable to begin a seventh string quartet commissioned by Ralph Hawks. Bartók died in West Side Hospital in New York City in September 1945. He was buried without ceremony or speeches in Ferncliff Cemetery in Hartsdale, New York. His widow, Dita, moved back to Budapest the following year and continued to play recitals of her husband's music. She died in November 1982. In July 1988, the remains of Béla Bartók were returned to his native Hungary for a state burial. And now a sidebar about Bartók in Chicago. Béla Bartók's name was hardly known here when the Chicago Symphony Orchestra gave the U.S. premiere of his second piano concerto in March 1939. The orchestra had played only two works, the Suite for Orchestra and the Dance Suite in the 1920s, and nothing since. That would eventually change. Bartók came to Chicago in April 1940. By then, many of the important creative musicians of pre-war Europe had moved to America after Bartók's departure from his native Hungary in late 1940 in anticipation of the Nazi invasion. He joined them. As soon as it was announced that Bartók would be coming to this country to give the U.S. premiere of his Rhapsody No. 1 with violinist Joseph Szigeti at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., the Arts Club of Chicago, which had already hosted both Arnold Schoenberg and Paul Hindemith, invited him for a dinner recital evening. At the Arts Club, which was then housed in the Wrigley Building, Bartók joined John Weicker, the Chicago Symphony's concertmaster, in the Rhapsody only 6 days after the Washington premiere and played selections from his newest work for piano, Mikroskosmos, so new that it's just being published today, the Tribune reported on April 10th. The pianist, Artur Rubinstein, who was in Chicago a week earlier, told the Tribune that Bartók was one of the very few great pianist composers of our time. Bartók returned in November 1941 to make his debut as a pianist with the Chicago Symphony, conducted by second music director Frederick Stock. The work, once again, was the second piano concerto, a score that had still not been played in any other U.S. city. The New York Philharmonic did not add the work to its repertory until 1951. the Boston Symphony 11 years after that. In the meantime, the Chicago Symphony had already programmed all three of Bartok's piano concertos, the first of the American orchestras to do so. In the years after Bartok's death in 1945, his music slowly gained ground in the Chicago Orchestra's repertoire, particularly under music directors Fritz Reiner and Sir George Scholte, whom both studied with the composer at the Budapest Academy of Music in the early 20th century and became among his most important champions. It was Reiner, along with Joseph Szigeti, who talked Serge Koussevitzky into offering Bartok the $1,000 fee for the landmark 1943 Concerto for Orchestra, which has become one of the anchors of the Chicago Symphony's 20th century repertoire. It was recorded by the orchestra under both Reiner and Scholte. 6 months after Scholte's death in 1997, his cremated remains were interred in a Budapest cemetery next to Bartok's plot. By now, the Chicago Symphony plays Bartok's music nearly every season, and certain pieces, the three piano concertos, the second violin concerto, music from The Miraculous Mandarin, music for strings, percussion, and celesta, and even the opera Bluebeard's Castle, are performed with a regularity the composer never lived to see. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.